Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, there's some exciting news out of the University of Pennsylvania about a potential genetic treatment for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Also, we'll meet a woman who calls herself Coach V. Valencia Peterson is dedicated to breaking the cycle of domestic violence among teens and young adults. Student Jacquez Mabin will be along as well. But to begin, you never know when shocking, almost unbelievable news might happen. And for the world of sports, it came on Sunday when word came that basketball superstar Kobe Bryant, his 13-year-old daughter Gianna, and seven others were killed in a helicopter crash in Calabasas, California. We say the world of sports, but locally, the impact is immense. Kobe Bryant was the basketball prodigy from Lower Merion High School who made the almost unheard-of jump to the NBA at the age of 17 in the mid-1990s. So we'll start the show with a remembrance of Kobe Bryant. The Philadelphia Inquirer's Marcus Hayes joins us now. Welcome back, Marcus.
Good morning, Mary. How are you?
Doing okay. What crossed your mind, Marcus, when you first heard of Kobe Bryant's death?
It's funny you should ask that. I received a call as I was courtside getting ready for my 10th grade girls' my 10th grade daughter's girls travel basketball game. My wife and I coach her. So we were doing what Kobe died on the way to do. He was going to coach his daughter, Gianna, in a travel basketball game. So, my wife was a player at the University of Pennsylvania. Basketball is a very, very big part of our life. All three of our girls play, and we have a 12-year-old. So, you know, we understand what it's like to, you know, be rushing to the next travel basketball game and to be, you know, thinking about what your game plan is going to be and talking to other players who carpool with you and things like that. So what went through my mind was, you know, I could be that guy.
Yeah.
You know, our kids are almost the same age. He's 10 years younger than me, but we, you know, our professional and personal lives have paralleled quite a bit. One of the first things I did in Philadelphia was I went to see Kobe Bryant play in high school with Lower Merion against Donnie Carr, who was playing for Roman Catholic, the basketball factory that gave you Rasheed Wallace and Wilt Chamberlain,
mm-hmm.
on an off night just to go watch him. So,
and you write in today's article, you were wondering what all the hubbub was about with this game.
You know, I came from Syracuse and I grew up in a small town and played basketball, but nobody played on college floors until you went to sectionals or states. And here you had two teams playing on a college floor in a non-league game in December. So what's the big deal? When I got there and saw Donnie Carr, who's now an assistant at LaSalle, and Kobe Bryant, who was, you know, as good as any of the Sixers at that point, when I saw them playing, I was like, wow, this is some second level stuff. Who is this kid?
You write of seeing this, quote, skinny, angular kid knife and slither and glide and handle like a third year NBA shooting guard. So at that point, Marcus, I mean, it was early days. I mean, were you imagining what the future might hold at the time for Kobe Bryant?
At that point, it wasn't sure that he was going to go pro. He would have been the first guard taken out of high school. If you go pro out of high school, went pro out of high school, you were a big prodigy. You were Moses Malone. You were Kevin Garnett, somebody like that. So for a guard to do it, and a guard who wasn't necessarily fully developed yet, was unprecedented. No one had ever done it before, especially someone who hadn't like been held back a grade, because Kobe was 17 as a senior. So it was just – but he was just different. Everything was so fluid and so natural and so easy. You could tell not only had he done the work, but he had the bloodlines. It was apparent he was going to be spectacularly good. And the intriguing thing was not so much was he going to go to college, because he dallied a little bit and teased LaSalle and Duke a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But how long it was going to take for him to have impact in the NBA. Could he hold up? Could he physically handle it? And he could. And he did. And the Lakers handled him properly, which is to their credit. But, you know, Kobe's only interest in life at that point was basketball. So he prepared himself and he took care of himself, and he was far, far ahead of his time.
As you say, his global fame for the next 20 years was matched by a precious handful.
I mean, Tiger, who's it was interesting. Tiger learned about Kobe's death after his round of golf yesterday at Torrey Pines in California, his caddy learned on, I think, like the 11th hole. So he ate it for about 2 hours. Kobe and Tiger were very close. But Kobe and Tiger are very similar on a lot of different levels. They're both very flawed. They've overcome a lot of things. They're about the same age, and they ascended, you know, thanks to helpful fathers very, very quickly and remarkably. And they were obsessed with what they did. And they turned out to be pretty good dads. So watching Tiger, literally watching Tiger find out after the round was maybe the most jarring thing for me since this happened. But yeah, there are very few. Maybe Serena Williams, who's the greatest tennis player of all time. Maybe Federer, but maybe not for as long. It's just a remarkable run because Kobe was the bridge between Michael Jordan and LeBron James.
We have an email from Kyle who says Kobe was so great because of the way he loved his daughter and supported her along with the rest of his family. Philly is blessed to be his original home. You also write, Marcus Hayes, that, you know, Kobe Bryant, he was a hometown kid, but the legacy in the Philly area was complicated.
It was. Kobe didn't claim Philadelphia nearly as much as Philadelphia claimed Kobe. And that's not the same as Lower Merion's relationship with Kobe, where Kobe went to high school. He considers Lower Merion to be the place where he became a man and has been very, very good to Lower Merion. And he hasn't been terrible to Philadelphia, but he's a Los Angelino.
Yeah.
He's very much a citizen of the world. Kobe spent, I think 8 of his formative years from the ages of 6 to 14, I believe, growing up in Italy where his dad was playing basketball. He doesn't sort of see himself as tethered to any one place. And it was necessary for Kobe, I think, to become Kobe by living in one of the most international cities the world has ever seen, Los Angeles, and being able to be anonymous every once in a while, but important at the same time. It was a good place for him to be, Los Angeles. I don't know that he would have been the same person if he had, for example, stayed in Charlotte for several years, the team that had his draft rights, or if he'd come to Philadelphia or been drafted by Philadelphia, number one overall instead of Al Iverson, you know. It would have been an interesting metamorphosis, and I don't think he would have stayed anywhere except L.A. I think he was going to be a Laker eventually because Los Angeles, the Lakers were his team growing up. He was a Los Angeles Lakers fan.
No mercy back in 2001 in the NBA Finals. And at one point, these are your words, Marcus Hayes, he became a Philly villain of Dallas proportions, which I guess some tough talk, you know, going into, I think it was game 4 of that series. But when something like this happens, Philadelphians are a forgiving lot. And of course, we're talking about the death of Kobe Bryant.
Well,
don't you think?
By 2015, December of 2015, when he came to Philadelphia, I think it was December 1st, he came to Philadelphia for his last game. He had a farewell year. And things were fine at that point. The resentment had died. It was 14 years after he told Philadelphia that he was going to cut their hearts out in game 4 of the 2001 NBA Finals. And things were different. He didn't dislike coming back to Philadelphia. He enjoyed coming back and seeing old friends. He was very, very loyal. He was very good to people that he was around when he was being raised. And he liked the cheesesteaks, and he liked the atmosphere, and he loved East Coast basketball. Kobe Bryant, for as elegant as he was a very, very physical, tough player. He didn't dislike Philadelphia, but he was a Los Angelino. And people in Philadelphia have a bigger problem with that, or had a bigger problem with that, than Kobe had with Philadelphia. Yeah. But you're right. Time tends to soften that sort of thing. And Kobe had softened himself from 2015 to 2020. He'd become a different person.
Yeah, you know, Saturday night, I think he tweeted LeBron James after James passed him on the all-time scoring list in the NBA.
That's evidence of the...
Which happened in Philly.
I guess the maturation. Yeah. And which happened in Philly of all places, right?
Yeah.
And that's evidence of the maturation because that was a real rivalry for a long time. You know, once Kobe reconciled himself to being mortal like the rest of us, when he, you know, stopped getting blood spinning and stopped eating bone broth all the time and realized that he too was mortal, I think it became easier for him to appreciate the game. One of the more telling things about Kobe and how obsessed he was with being great is he wouldn't watch NBA games after he retired until his kids started asking him to watch them with them.
Really?
Yes. Kobe could not bear to watch much NBA basketball. And, you know, this is the kind of dad he was. And, of course, you know, he has unlimited funds and lots of time. He would take Gianna, his I believe his second daughter, the daughter who died in the crash with him, he would take her to UConn because she wanted to play for Gina Auriemma one day. So they'd travel to UConn for a game. Or they'd travel to Atlanta to see Trae Young, her favorite player, play. That's the sort of involvement. That's the sort of commitment Kobe Bryant had to his four daughters.
I had read that Gianna, who died in the crash with him, was a basketball star at age 13 in her own right. Kobe Bryant won an Academy Award in 2018 for his animated short film, Dear Basketball. Marcus, did you happen to see it? I did not, and now I want to.
I saw parts of it, and the most remarkable thing about it was the production. They did some really clever things with the production, like the way that they animated sweat. They devised a method by which they could animate sweat realistically for the kind of animation that they did. It was like everything Kobe touched, it was as well done as he could possibly make it. I mean, he also wrote two children's books. He was a Harry Potter nerd, as am I. There's nothing wrong with that.
As am I.
And he had published the first of, I think it's called the Wizenert series, the training camp about, you know, basketball and young people. He was very, very interested in young people. That's what the focus was, his and Vanessa's foundation. And the second book, season one, will be out March 20th. And he's the kind of person who would have done more in his second act than he did in his first. It reminds you sort of Magic Johnson, or former Senator Bill Bradley, or, you know, they're just athletes who are much, much more than athletes, who are good citizens, who are contributors to our society. And Kobe was flawed, don't get me wrong. I mean, Phil Jackson once wrote that he was uncoachable. He was, you know, in 2011, he got in hot water for using a gay slur against a referee. He diminished the Trayvon Martin shooting. And, of course, in 2003, he was accused of raping a woman in a Colorado hotel. And while none of those things are okay in the moment, I believe that Kobe grew from all of those things. I believe Kobe was a different person in 2020 than he was in 2011 with the gay slur, or the first time with Phil Jackson in Los Angeles, and certainly in 2003 in that hotel room in Colorado, where he admitted he did something wrong. The charges were eventually dropped, and there was a civil case that he settled. But I believe Kobe Bryant was very flawed, but eager to work on the flaws and become better.
Very quick question. As we wrap up, you are getting on a plane for L.A. later today, Marcus?
That's right.
All right. So you'll be reporting from Los Angeles more on this story.
I will be, yes. The Clippers play the Lakers on Tuesday night, and it's going to be an interesting assignment, to say the least.
Okay. Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Up next, a potential groundbreaking therapy for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There are approximately 400 new cases of Duchenne muscular dystrophy diagnosed in the U.S. every year. Duchenne is one of the most common and severe forms of muscular dystrophy, and for those who are affected by it, the diagnosis can be devastating. Most people with DMD are unable to walk by their teenage years, and the disease can eventually affect the heart and respiratory muscles. Well, there is new hope coming out of groundbreaking research happening at the University of Pennsylvania, a genetic treatment which has shown promise in animals with the disease. And here to talk about it is Hansel Stedman, attending surgeon at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and Director of the Muscular Dystrophy Research Institute for Human Gene Therapy. Welcome, Hansel.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Yuva Gambeer is a senior at Masterin High School in Philadelphia. He has worked with Hansel Stedman as an intern on research into this gene therapy, and he happens to have DMD as well. Great to have you with us, Yuva.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here.
First, let's get more of a sense of how Duchenne works. It primarily affects boys, correct, Hansel?
That's correct. It's a so-called X-linked recessive disease, often passed on by an asymptomatic carrier female.
And in young boys, and then it progresses through a young person's teen years?
Right. Yuva can step in here.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about your first diagnosis and tell us a bit about your journey with Duchenne and how it shaped your life, Yuva.
Yeah, sure. So around the age of 3, my parents noticed I had trouble walking and keeping up with the other kids physically. So after a trip to the doctors, they sent me over to the hospital to get some scans. And it was soon after that that my neurologist realized that I had Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And I guess kind of talking about living with Duchenne, there's obviously many challenges associated with Duchenne. Around the age of 12, I lost my ability to walk. And since then, I've become fully dependent on my wheelchair for getting around. I can't stand on my own or even raise my arms above my head. So I'm fully reliant on others to help me out with anything that involves physical activity. If you look at it in school, I have an aide who will help me get books from my bag and settle me in different classrooms, help me navigate through the halls, busy high school classes. Yeah. And apart from being reliant on others, a large portion of my day goes toward maintaining various aspects of my health. I have to do daily physical therapies and miss school often for doctor's appointments. And being a high school senior, it's certainly challenging managing the robust workload along with saving time for social engagements.
And yet you were helping to shape the research into Duchenne. Tell us about that. How did you get involved, Yuva?
Yeah, so in the summer of 2017, I actually was enrolled in a 3-week course at UPenn about just like a brief overview and about biomedical research. So I got to learn there. What drove me to join that program was that while I obviously know a lot about the physical symptoms associated with my disease, I was really interested to learn more about what was going on in molecular level. So that prompted me to join this program and start just diving into things and learning about what's going on. And in that program, there's actually a specific class where you can concentrate on one particular focus and concentration. So by chance, there happened to be a club that was reviewing the latest research regarding Duchenne. And I remember right away emailing the program coordinators and saying, I want to be in this group. And it was interesting to me how at first they wanted to confirm and make sure that being in such a club where they spoke openly about my disease was something that I would be comfortable with.
And how did you become comfortable with that?
Well, for me, it always just felt like a natural thing to want to dive in and learn more about what's happening at a molecular level and see what I could do maybe to help with current research through any way that I can, either by actual bench work in the lab with Dr. Stedman and his team.
Let's get into a little bit more about the therapy that you are working on, Hansel and Yuva. And correct me if I'm wrong, there's a protein called, is it dystrophin?
Yes.
I got that right, the pronunciation. All right. So, but there's a lack of this particular protein in the muscles of people who happen to have Duchenne, and this affects the muscle weakness or causes the muscle weakness?
That's right. And 30 years on from its discovery, we're still not 100% sure what the protein does. We're just painfully aware that in its absence, muscle cell will break down over time and then will usually be replaced by fibrous tissue that doesn't function as muscle. So the part of Yuva's bravery is to look through a microscope at exactly that process and see the sort of a nuanced view of how this takes place. But on the exciting side of this, to see how if we intervene with a genetic therapy for this, that we can reverse that whole process.
It's not as simple, though, as replacing dystrophin with more dystrophin, right?
That's a great question. And the reason it's not as simple is exemplified by the fact that the gene therapy program at UPenn, which is one of the leading in the world, is the gene therapy and vaccines program. So everyone there is painfully aware that what the immune system thinks about a gene therapy is in many, many cases the defining moment of whether your injection cures a patient or leads to a devastating outcome.
Such as, well, what could happen if the immune system is not happy with what you are trying to achieve? What could possibly happen in a patient?
You could have a devastating immune response against it. So, for instance, if your body has never seen the protein dystrophin before because you have this disease for a genetic reason, and then all of a sudden some well-intentioned virus vector comes along and restores dystrophin to muscles throughout the body, our most recently published paper shows that that can be devastating for the cells that are now making this protein the immune system has never seen, because the immune system can go after it as if it's a virus-infected cell. And, you know, one of the ways your body is going to fight off the coronavirus that's coming our way is that your immune system has a no-holds-barred approach to cells that look like they're infected. It's a high-stakes game for your body.
Yeah.
If cells that are infected with virus are not taken out quickly, they replicate and create thousands and thousands of more virions to infect more cells. So that's why your immune system kicks in very aggressively at this point.
And it can even be deadly.
Right. So the opportunity we had in this paper, and it was huge for us to have Yuva in the lab at exactly the point that the paper was submitted and that we were looking at reviewers'
and published, yeah.
And eventually published, was that we had found a surrogate means of getting around this. So the body is already making a variation on dystrophin that's present even in Duchenne muscular dystrophy. But this variation is usually turned off before the cells mature into adulthood. But by hooking a synthetic version of the gene for that protein up to something that would turn it back on in adult cells, we found that it was essentially curative in mice and that it came a very, very long way towards cure in man's best friend, and not just one but two breeds of dog. And importantly, one breed of dog had a complete deletion of dystrophin.
So, and these animals can actually have a very human-like form of Duchenne.
Accelerated it by about 10x.
Definitely. And when you talk about this other protein, it's called utrophin, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And the concept is to somehow, I guess, again, genetically engineer a virus to carry utrophin to, well, first, I guess, in mice and dogs and eventually humans to see if that might mitigate the effects of Duchenne, Yuva?
Yeah, eventually humans. So utrophin, like, although dystrophin could be expected to trigger this immunogenic response, because it's almost like people with Duchenne have never actually had utrophin being produced. So it's a completely foreign substance coming into the body. But utrophin is not expected to trigger such a response because human beings develop an immunogenic tolerance to it while they're even in utero. And I'll steal an analogy from Dr. Stedman here that kind of liked. But you can kind of think of dystrophin as Carson Wentz and utrophin like the Nick Foles. And even though it's not the utrophin still knows the playbook and can get the job done in the body.
I love it. So do you expect it to win the Super Bowl?
Yeah, we'll have to see, but I think it's on the way.
So, I mean, but it has shown, using utrophin has shown early promise in mice and dogs, right? So do we expect, when do human trials happen? Or are we even close?
That's going to be in the realm of biotechnology commercialization. And that's an ongoing process that we're very excited about. It sort of very quickly outstrips the usual NIH budget for moving basic science into the clinic. So you have to reach out, if you will, to Wall Street to find the oomph to move this forward. But at the moment, there are several games in play. There are companies that have decided to move a dystrophin version of this into clinical trials. And while there's a signal of promise there, there's also a very, very worrisome signal of immunological response. And it's not fully understood, but high on the list of possibilities is an immune response against the very protein that is so essential. So our contribution is to come up with a backdoor way to address the Nick Foles way to get at this.
So we might be talking about a few years then before a company actually takes this up?
Well, the companies,
when I say that, I mean, and probably incorrectly, I'm talking about human trials.
Probably more like a few days to weeks before a company takes this up, but more like a few years before you have an FDA-approved product. So there's a process there that Yuva is very well aware of.
So Yuva, when you are in the lab with Dr. Stedman and you are looking through the microscope, are you able to, you know, kind of as a scientist, separate the emotion because you're involved in this so intimately with what you're seeing, you know, the deterioration, in cells in dogs and mice? How do you do your work and can you separate yourself from it?
Yeah, it's definitely It's tricky sometimes to see like the true impacts of Duchenne, and I haven't progressed fully, but I've seen like where this disease can go and the really detrimental effects. But I'm not sure. I feel like as learning about my disease at like a genotypical level actually is empowering in some way, and I kind of fostered this connection with Leon Morales, who. He was the one who actually ran that journal club about Duchenne, and he also suffers from a form of muscular dystrophy, much milder form, but still type of muscular dystrophy nonetheless. And I think also through him and being able to interact with him at that journal club, that's when this started fully like germinating that the idea of maybe understanding my disease at a scientific level could actually be empowering rather than debilitating and inhibiting me from wanting to learn more.
You're helping to make progress on it. Do you hope is for, well, let's talk about this particular gene therapy. I'd read Hansel Stedman that for potential human patients, it would probably be best serve people who are young, like little boys best. And there are some girls too who have Duchenne, but mostly boys again. To get started on the therapy, you probably need to be young, or do I have that correct?
That's an area of complete uncertainty.
Okay.
Okay. And the studies to bear that out will probably be pretty expensive at this point. You have to at some point throw a stake in the ground and say, here's how we're going to design this trial. And then you have to make a choice. Are we going to inject really young boys, the younger the better, or are we going to go all the way to someone Yuva's age? And maybe there's a fork in the road where you can actually do both, but with perhaps different expectations based on the gaps in our knowledge about how this will work out in animal models.
So do you foresee that there will actually be a cure for Duchenne muscular dystrophy within, say, the next decade? How rapidly is research and technology moving forward? Hansel?
So I first met Yuva through an organization with the bold name Cure Duchenne. Almost an oxymoron. You juxtapose these two words that signify violently opposites in our world. And the question is this a realistic expectation? And we live day to day in the lab with the belief from our own science that this is technologically feasible. Not so much a matter of whether, but when. So we have some really exciting but as yet unpublished work that had a lot to do with what Yuva was doing on a day-to-day basis when he was in the lab. And maybe he can tell you about the species he was working on. Little unexpected, but this we think is going to be an opportunity for getting at the cure side of the equation.
Really? Yuva?
Yeah, so this is I spent a lot of time during the lab in 2018 helping with this paper that has not yet been released yet, but one of the things that we worked on was staining the muscle cells of jellyfish, and they have a similar dystrophin protein structure to humans, and that was definitely interesting because once we spliced the tissue, we got to stain for the dystrophin protein and look under a microscope. And there's a lot going on with looking at the evolution of dystrophin and where it really originated from and how we actually, our dystrophin is very analogous to the dystrophin even in jellyfish.
Isn't that interesting? So. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but this sounds enormously exciting. And for somebody who happens to have Duchenne, are you enormously excited about the potential that the breakthrough might be in the near future?
Yeah, obviously I'm very excited for any type of breakthrough in the near future. And I definitely see, like, there's been a lot going on in the field recently. There's been an explosion of new research going into Duchenne, and all kinds of scientists like Dr. Stedman and his team who are working tirelessly to find a cure that could help me and so many others. And although some of these treatments out there seem like they may be more beneficial for those who haven't progressed yet and for younger children, I'm still equally excited for treatments that could help all future people who will suffer from Duchenne. And even for those who have further on the spectrum of progression, I do foresee something, maybe not one particular thing, but a cocktail of things that could definitely be super helpful, especially like things that Dr. Stedman and his lab are working on.
We only have about a minute left. Funding is enormously important. Duchenne has been around. The gene for Duchenne was discovered, I think, 30 years ago. So it's been a long time coming in terms of, I would imagine, funding and breakthroughs. You are on the forefront of funding, Yuva. Tell us about what the work you're doing there briefly and why it is so important to bring dollars into this so it can progress. Yuva and then Hansel.
Well, yeah. Well, first from at the time I spent at the lab, Dr. Stedman's lab, I saw that fundraising and raising money to continue such like groundbreaking work is crucial in this field, and grants and things like that and investments from other organizations are definitely essential if we want to move forward. And from my experiences with fundraising, each year my family organizes a black tie fundraiser here in Philadelphia called Blingo that raises money for Duchenne.
And you it's know always. What? Unfortunately, we're up against the clock here, but Blingo, we'll remember that. Hansel, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us. Hansel Stedman.
Thank you so much. And a shout out to the Camden Aquarium for their help with these jellyfish.
He is attending surgeon at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Yuva Gambhir, senior at Masterman High, on to Penn after graduation. Thank you so much for joining us. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Domestic violence takes the lives of approximately 19 people every year in Philadelphia, according to the group Women Against Abuse. Many more incidents end in injury to women and men. City police, it's estimated, respond to at least 100,000 911 calls on domestic situations annually. Some of those likely involve teen relationships. By some estimates, the number of Philly students physically hurt by a boyfriend or girlfriend is nearly double the national average. And this is where a woman who calls herself Coach V is stepping in. Valencia Peterson teaches a class which attempts to break the cycle of domestic violence and sexual assault among teens and young adults. She is also head of a nonprofit called Open Door Abuse Awareness and Prevention. And Valencia Peterson is here with us now in studio to talk about her work. Hi.
Hi. Hi.
And along with her is Jacquez Maben, a football player?
Yes.
At, Penwood High School.
Correct.
Okay. We're kind of winging it here this, this
right.
hour on Radio
right.
Time. So great to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, you know, on a serious note, when we think of domestic violence, the picture that often comes to mind is that of a woman who is being abused by a partner. Maybe she has children. You know, it can be difficult and dangerous to escape the situation. But fair to say, domestic violence between young people in high school and college is not talked about as often, but yeah. It does exist. And Valencia, does it mirror what we see in adults?
Oh, my gosh, yes, definitely. Definitely, because it starts, you know, a lot of our kids, they're dealing with learned behaviors, right? They see it at home. They think it's normal. And then they do it, too. So what ODAP does, we seek to break that cycle by making them aware of the fact that they might be following in a step that's an abusive pattern. And many times our kids will say, is that abuse? We didn't know that was abuse. That's a normal action in our home.
Mm. Well, so give us an example of what you're talking about.
One of our players, we were talking together, and he went with a talk with me. I like taking my players out with me. And he decided to speak, and he mentioned how ODAP particularly helped him and his family because he had noticed his dad treating his mom a certain way. Mm-hmm. And before being in a program, he would never have understood how that wasn't right. So as he was talking freely, just freely, he ends up saying, you know, to everybody, well, I'm really proud because now I'm teaching my dad how to treat my mother. Now, I didn't expect that, right? I didn't know. But because we were asked to come and speak about our program, I just let him, kind of like what I'm doing today, I bring my players because they're the future of ODAP.
Yeah.
And I want them to see what we're doing and the impact we're having. But he surprised me by saying that. So now we're affecting generations because this young man is going back. He is talking to his dad. And he's explaining, this is not what we should do, Dad. I'm learning that. And because of that, Dad is called to account. And then I meet Dad, right?
Yeah.
I meet Dad because I'm very involved in my players' lives.
Jacquez, what did you think when you first saw Coach V on the sidelines?
Oh, when I first saw Coach V on the sidelines, it was a new experience because I was like, who is this lady? I'm not exactly sure who she is and why she's here. But then, like, when I actually came to the sideline, like, during halftime, and I seen her, she told us to, like, keep our heads up and, like, stay focused on the game. So I'm like, oh, I'm thinking she's here to be a motivational speaker. But then after that, like, after the game was over, she was like, no, I'm actually here to coach you guys and, like, to be here for a new program I'm starting up called ODAP, Open Doors Abuse Awareness Prevention.
Yeah.
And I want to help you guys, and, like, I want you guys to be the foundation of this program, and I want to build up and, like, make it go, like, nationwide, worldwide, however far we can get it.
When you first start to talk to young people, and you do talk to both young men and young women,
yes, yes.
But in this case, of course, we're talking about a football team.
Yeah.
What do you first start to talk about? Anger? How do you begin to talk to young people? Because I know, you know, from my own children, sometimes when you're an adolescent, you don't necessarily want to talk to adults, open up to adults, because you keep things close to the vest. So how do you begin?
Basically, just by being present. How about that? Just by being present. You know, I observe them, right? Like you might have read an article on Wednesday mornings. I go to Penwood 6:45. I have on a shirt that says free hugs. I'm just there, right? Every Wednesday. I've been doing this for years, right, Jacquez? He comes in and gets his hug every morning.
Yes.
But I'm just there. And I may compliment them. I really like your hair today. You can do it. Right? Just simple stuff, right? And then they'll see me again. It is about being present. It's not so much about what to say. They don't care how much you know. They just want to know how much you care.
But you also tackle issues head on.
Yes.
Like anger and anger management.
Yes.
Where do you go with that? And what are some of the stresses in a young person's life that might lead to anger against somebody else in a relationship? And I'm going to ask you the same thing too, Jacquez, but let's let Valencia answer first.
Well, first of all, I have to give a shout out to Lakeside Global Institute. They've done so much in trauma, and I've been a part of their organization and learning from them. But the first thing I really try to do is make them aware, right? I have a program or exercise I do where I get them to start to think about, where is your anger starting from? Where does it start? And I had them put a dot on that area of their body. And they, first of all, it made them stop and think about, where does my anger come from, right? That's the first thing. Once they realize where their anger comes from, now we can start to help regulate. Because you know, right before you're going to hit somebody, your fist will ball up, right? You have a reaction in your body. So by making them aware of that original reaction, they can go, okay, my fists are starting to ball up. I'm starting to get angry. Or my face or my cheek is tightening up, I'm starting to get angry, right? So the idea is bringing awareness to their own bodies, their own sensations, so that they can start to take a different course, if you will. Okay, I need to remove myself. I'm getting worked up, right? And this is a way to get them regulated. So this is one of the things I definitely do with my students I work with, bringing awareness to how they feel.
Jacquez, what was your reaction when Coach V first started talking about anger? Did you feel anybody was an angry person on the team, or as a young person experiencing anger, and how you might deal with that?
Okay, my reaction on how she brought up anger was, I was going to say, like, what exactly the sticker situation she brought up, I was going to say, like, I put one on my head because, like, I think a lot. So I think
that's where the anger might be, so the physical manifestation of it. Okay.
So I think a lot before I react, and then I put one on my heart because my heart, like, it starts racing, and it's like, I just got that feeling, and I don't want to, like, I don't want to do nothing. It's like something that's boiling up inside me, and like I don't know what to do. And then I put one on my hand because I get angry like fast, but I don't want to like hit nothing or react out of consciousness.
Yeah. So you found that helpful?
Yes, I did.
So let's talk about relationships, as opposed to maybe somebody you might get angry with, a teammate or somebody else, you know, who you might know in your neighborhood. How is it difficult to navigate? It's been a long time since I've been. I guess you're probably about 17, 18 years old. It's been a long time since I've been there. You know, what's it like navigating relationships at your age, Jaquez?
Okay, so navigating relationships at my age, it's a different time in high school. I mean, like, it's a lot going on. So, like, I have a girlfriend, okay? She travels back and forth to New York and Philadelphia a lot because she's from there. So it's like I try and like make time with her because I also play baseball and I play football. So it's like I'm trying to make time with her and make time for my activities and school at the same time. So it's stressful, but like, you know, you have to do it. So I guess I'm preferring like as an adult, like how you have like if you work two jobs and like you got kids, it's like trying to find time to make for your kids. Like you gotta make it work. You gotta make it stretch. So, like,
that should tell you how serious it is they take these relationships.
Yeah. But if there's a lot on your plate, that can be stressful.
Yeah.
And I think when you're teaching young people about, I think there was a quote I pulled from an article, normalized behavior that shouldn't be considered to be normal.
Exactly.
Tell us about what some of that is and how you coach young people to kind of, you know, reject what this normalized behavior and how to employ healthier techniques in maintaining a good relationship.
Right. So it's a lot about bringing awareness. Okay. It's a lot about educating our kids. They can, you know, they're there. They understand. I think we need to give them more credit about comprehending these things. I think we shield them too much. That's a whole nother story. I won't go there. I could go off so many places.
You can talk
speak
openly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I could go on and on. You know, I did a workshop and I think some parents said, well, sixth grade is too early to start talking about these things. And I differ. I beg to differ because it's so true. They're ready already.
When you talk about some things, Valencia, what are you talking about?
Like how we respond to, again, it's a lot about how we respond to what we're being exposed to. Again, toxic. You're in a family. The culture of that family is screaming and hollering at each other, right? This is what they know. But then you come to Miss Coach V and I'm talking about verbal abuse and I'm giving a description of exactly what's going on in your home every day. And they're looking at me like that's abuse. And I'm saying, yes, it is.
So how do you counsel them? How do you coach them?
I coach them by giving them the tools that they need. You know, I explain to them the right way to speak to someone. Right. I explain to them exactly what is the right way to be in a relationship. Right. What it looks like to be in a healthy relationship, what you should do in particular circumstances, because I get, you know, a lot of questions. My girlfriend is this and that. How do I respond? And so I'm walking them through literally every situation and they differ. So there's been so many. I can't pull one out like boom, you know, yeah. But there's been so many of like, for instance, a young man from Del Valle hit me up and he was going through something with his girlfriend. Had a bad situation with his family and his dad and didn't want to repeat this with his girlfriend. My first reaction to him was, first of all, think about where this really is coming from. Does this have anything to do with what's gone on with you in your life? And he was able to connect the dots, right? I've told young men, start journaling your feelings. Look at where you're coming from and seeing if there's a connection to where you're going now, right? And I think that's the big awareness here. I don't think our kids really get how where they are right now are going to affect them where they are now, you know?
Jaquez, Coach V asks young men, teams, classes to take the pledge. What is the pledge?
Okay, so the pledge is you vow to respect women, respect yourself and learn how to be it's etiquette in it and learn how to be a man.
So what that means is, because you know that's a lot, oh my gosh, this is so short to hear so much of what we do, but it means helping each other to respect women too by respecting yourself first. I mean, I have young men that have been not just a bystander and not saying anything. They're calling each other to account. This pledge is a lot of them making a commitment to be respectable themselves and make sure that the guys around them are doing the exact same thing.
That can be hard to do, Jacquez. If you know, I mean, there's peer pressure, and so how do you step out of that when you see somebody doing something that you've learned through Coach V might not be healthy? You know, what do you say to a friend?
If I feel like it's too toxic, like, I will go up to the person, I will approach them and be like, hey, this is not what you're supposed to be doing. Like, you have to, like, treat her this way or treat this person that way. You can't just be, like, sitting here grabbing around by the neck, flinging around the hallway. I understand that's, like, your girlfriend or your loved one or whoever it is, but, like, that's not the right way to do that. Like, you do that, not even on your old time. You're not supposed to do it at all, but, like, If you feel like you're going to put your hands on that person, like, don't just walk away and or just tell them how you truly feel and be like, okay, I need some space. I need some space to cool down. I don't want to be around you right now. Stuff like that. You got to communicate. Communication is key. If you don't have communication, you don't have nothing.
And honestly, sometimes in a toxic situation, it can escalate. So also, I'm assuming, Valencia, that you're going to say, you know, have some adults perhaps that you can turn to perhaps also bring into the situation.
Definitely.
Does that work, Jacquez?
One of my young men recently was in the hallway, and I think a girl kind of went at him real hard. Mm-hmm. And I got calls from some of the administration and his mother to say that they were impressed about his response, because all he did was grab her hands, right? And he said, look, stop, right? Just stop. Stop doing this, right? Because one of the things we do a lot is try to teach our young men how to handle these toxic situations, right? The walking away, to realizing of your anger. You notice that you got this small window before you react. What do you do? Because you've had a sticker, you've seen the, you know, that you got to make a decision to walk away. But what I was proud about was his mother called me and said, Coach V, I just want to tell you that my son did the right thing, and the thing that he said was on his mind was that he knew that he's part of ODAP and he could not hit this girl.
Now, we do talk, we've been talking about young men. We could use a whole, probably another hour to talk about this. Young women, so how does the program change a little bit when you're talking about young women?
As a matter of fact, we're on the cusp of doing that right now. In the school that I'm working at, I've been working with my young men since 2014. And now the girls are saying, what about us? What about us? What about us? So as of today, exactly, I'm introducing a program to the teachers at Penwood called I See You, and it's all for young women. And all it's going to be is an opportunity to sit down and hear where they're coming from, because apparently there's a reason why they're doing what they're doing, right? This is the same thing that goes for my guys, for them too. Somewhere along the line, they're hurting. They're experiencing something that's making them do what they do. So what my motto is, while there's never, ever, ever an excuse for abuse, there's always a reason why people do what they do. And the point is to get to that. So with ICU, this program we're starting now, we're hoping to get the girls to start getting in a safe space where we can start breaking down and tackling some of the stuff that's going on with them right now.
Jacquez, do you see taking any of this info once you graduate, moving on to whichever is the next step, you know, college, you know, with you and in an entirely different environment where you don't know the young people?
Yes, I actually will. I will take this with me. I will keep this forever and forever. Like, I'll wear the shirt with pride, the ODAP integrity shirt. And I will, if anybody asks me what it means, I'll tell them what it means to be a part of ODAP, especially like in a college, like where they won't know, and like where a lot of this actually happened, where drugs and like sexual stuff, like a lot of this happens. I'll like tell them to reach out to Ms. V. I'll take them if I even have to. And like, yeah, I help them out a lot.
All right. Basically. Thank you so much, Jacquez Maben of Penwood High School. Great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Valencia Peterson, it was a pleasure. Good
Thank
luck in
you.
Your work.
Thank you.
Valencia Peterson is the head of the nonprofit called Open Door Abuse Awareness and Prevention. Don't forget to stay in touch via social media. You'll find us at WHYY.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Good to have you with us for Radio Times.